We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Economics at Kingston University, London, Steve King, and looking to be the first crowdfunded economist through Patreon. And I want to touch on that a little bit later in the interview, Professor, but welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I should also say, author of your most recent, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis, which I believe is now just available in the United States.
Yes, finally come out, and it's also now available on Kindle. That didn't actually happen until the American version was launched.
Great. And so let's start with the argument that you make, and this is one that you have been making for some time, I think, that is based on your on models that that Hyman Minsky developed. Will you tell us who Hyman Minsky was and what his from your perspective, his big contribution to economics is?
Well, fundamentally, he actually asked the right question, because in the aftermath of the Great Depression and the Second World War, you'd think we'd be talking about how do we avoid that experience again. But most of economics was occupied with the sort of navel-gazing question of, can we derive macroeconomics from micro? Minsky distinguished himself in the middle of the 1950s, when the economy was booming, by asking the question, what caused the Great Depression, and can it happen again? And his answer was very, very different to what the mainstream believed, which is why when the crisis came along, anybody who believed the mainstream was completely shocked. Anybody who followed Minsky said, I could see it coming.
And in fact, you did see the 2008 crisis coming. What elements are present when we are in a sort of, I guess, en route to such a crisis?
Well, it's fundamentally what's happening with credit, because people who don't do an economics degree might be shocked to hear this, but it's absolute gospel truth. Mainstream economists don't even have money, banks, or debt in their models. They presume you can model capitalism while excluding, not even acknowledging the existence of the financial sector. Now, that's absurd, and if you think it's crazy, you're right. But what Minsky said is you've got to look at the level of private debt, and there's a tendency in capitalism for people to borrow money during a boom, have to repay it during a recession. So over a period of time, the level of debt ratchets up until you get to such a point, which was nicknamed the Minsky moment some years ago, where when the crunch comes again, the accumulated need to repay the debt overwhelms your cash flows, and without another source of spending, such as from a government sector or from massive exports, if you're lucky, you're going to continue going a black hole of bankruptcy. And that's the entire economy going that way. So that's what—that's the phenomenon that I identified in my mathematical models of Minsky back in the early 90s. And, of course, it's what I saw coming in 2006 when I started warning about the crisis being inevitable.
And so, I mean, when you just tease that out for us as lay people, what does that mean that the classical economists don't calculate finance? I mean, they calculate finance insofar as, you know, maybe there's 500 employees at this office of Goldman Sachs in New Jersey or something, right? But you're saying the activity itself is not calculated in the context of what?
Of their models of the economy. So, for example, the absolute ants pants of a mathematical model of the USA economy was actually done in Europe by a couple of guys called Smets and Wouters back in 2007. And that model had no financial sector, no banks, and no debt. So consequently, they were looking at all the elements of their own model to say what's likely to happen to the economy. And those they did not include where the crisis came from, which was the financial sector. It's ridiculous. It's a travesty that this has been happening. But people like myself on the inside of economics have been rebels, have been seeing this going on for 40 years. So if you look, on the other hand, if you follow Minsky and you say, well, it's absolutely essential to know what's happening with debt and private credit, then we can see there was a unsustainable credit boom going on, which had to come to an end. And when it did, the economy would tank.
Tell us what Minsky's financial instability hypothesis is.
Okay. It basically says capitalism is a cyclical economy with booms and slumps, And whenever you take any particular point in time, there would have been a crisis caused by some sort of a debt overhang, private debt overhang in the not too distant past. But as you have a period of tranquil growth after that period, people tend to forget the crisis. So a period of tranquil economic activity leads to rising expectations, meaning people are willing to borrow money. They borrow money, and by borrowing money, they actually lever up their gains from sales and do very well out of leverage. So there's a tendency to go from depressed expectations after a crash to tranquil expectations to euphoric expectations, as Minsky called it. And then you'll borrow money to finance anything, a bit like the dot-com bubble. As that happens, you drive up the money, the people who are doing the borrowing, the businesses start to drive up wages, drive up raw materials costs, cut into their own profitability, by the change in distribution of income they weren't expecting. Interest rates might get hiked by the Federal Reserve as well, but that's an ancillary factor. That then means that they're not making as much profit as they thought they would. They stop investing, the economy goes into a slump, and you repeat the whole process again. But as that happens, you end up with a residue of additional debt because you incurred the, you borrowed the money during a boom, you're repaying it during a slump, you don't pay quite as much. So when the next boom happens, you're starting with a higher level of private debt. And that keeps on happening every time until finally you get to a point where you take on such a level of private debt that when the crunch comes, the debt servicing is still so enormous that cutting workers' wages and cutting raw materials prices simply doesn't cut it. You still end up unable to finance it, and you have a collapse in spending. You go from a credit boom to a credit bust. And in America's case, that happened in 2007, 2008. And you went from credit, which is change in private debt, the annual change in private debt, went from being plus 15% of GDP to minus 5% in 2 years. And that was a complete collapse in demand, which led to the Great Recession.
And so you refer to the United States as one of those countries that is a walking dead of debt, and you compare it to zombies to be. Give us a sense of what those countries are and what does it mean to be... the United States, the personal debt, my understanding is, has gone down from where it was, but is now starting to look like it might be going the other direction again.
Yeah. And if you go right back to the end of the Second World War, America's level of private debt was about 30% of GDP. It then rose in that sort of series of booms and slumps, as Minsky described it, up to a peak in 2009 of 170% of GDP. You then de-leave it about 20%, so you're at about 150% of GDP as a debt level now, and there's a bit of borrowing going on by both private sector, particularly the corporate sector, so that's actually stimulating demand to some extent now, which is why there's a apparent recovery going on. But with that level of debt, you're like you climbed one mountain step below the peak of Mount Everest, and you're not going to climb back above the height of Mount Everest again. So you're going to go have a bit of a boom. Then if anything such as the Federal Reserve putting up rates starts cutting into your capacity to service that debt, you're going to have a slowdown in the rate of growth of credit, and you'll go back into a slump again. And Japan started doing this back in 1990 and has been doing it for one quarter of a century. And they're sitting on much the same level of debt that America is on now, about 150, 160% of GDP as the private debt level. They're obsessing about the public debt. They're not looking at the private debt. And that's what is really trapping them, which means that Japan hasn't had nominal growth in the GDP for 30 years.
Let's talk about that. I want to get into, sort of the zombies to be. But before we get there, let's talk about the difference between private debt and public debt. And maybe this is also a good time to talk about the modern monetary theorists who are getting some there was just recently, I don't know, there seems to be a growing enthusiasm about those folks, and I'm curious as to what your perspective is on that.
Yeah. Well, what they're fundamentally doing is they're saying that let's actually look at how money is created. Because we all think about saving money, and this is the obsession, let's save some cash, and that we then extrapolate that to the national level, and the government should save money, therefore the government should run a surplus. What they say is, well, let's look at how money is actually created, and can you save money at the aggregate level? Can a national economy save, increase the amount of money in existence? It turns out you can only do that if the money factories are producing the money for you to save, increase the amount of money in your bank accounts. And there are fundamentally two money factories. Banks create money by lending out more than they get back in repayments. And governments create money by spending more than they get back in taxation. Now, there's no practical limit to the capacity of the state to do that. But everybody acts as if the government has to tax before it can spend. And the point of view of modern monetary theory is to say, well, no, in fact, because we accept government liabilities, which are banknotes in the physical sense, or entries in our bank balance if they make a cash for clunkers type exchange to us, we accept that as money we can spend. Other people accept us spending that money. So the government is basically has an unlimited capacity to create money domestically. It's then a question whether it does that responsibly or sufficiently. And the great trouble of the last 20, 30 years is because we've been dominated by a school of thought which originally called itself monetarist, but actually ignored the existence of money and its bloody mathematical models, pardon me being an Australian there and swearing, but because it ignored the money, it ignored the fact that the government could create that money and wasn't actually limited in its capability. So what we had, of course, the government wasn't creating enough money. That was a necessity to go and then borrow that money from the private sector. That's partly what caused the housing boom and then the crash that came after that. So modern monetary theory says we can get out of this if the state creates the money we need to help, you know, pay that debt down, stimulate the economy and so on. In that sense, they're basically being just real, as realistic as accountants and saying, is it possible for the government to do this? And if it does it, do people accept the money? The answer is yes and yes. So why don't we do it?
And so how does that, jibe with what you are saying insofar as, I mean, you're talking about private debt, and there's a sense, I think, in modern monetary theory that if the government runs a surplus, that is that money is basically shows up as debt on the private side, right? And vice versa, if I'm not mistaken.
Something like that. I mean, yeah, if you just I did a little mental exercise for people, which I think seems to clarify things fairly well. Draw a rectangle and call that the economy, and then cut it in two and say the left-hand side's the private sector, the right-hand side's the government sector. If the government runs a surplus, that means it's going to tax the private sector more than it spends on the private sector. So that, let's say you've got a GDP of $1 trillion, $1 trillion in money supply. The government's got a debt of 100% of GDP. GDP is $2 trillion. It tries to pay it down by taxing you 5% of GDP. That means it's going to take $100 billion out of your bank account. Now, once you put it that way and say the government running a surplus means you run an identical deficit, then the question is, well, if they take $100 billion out of our accounts, where do we get $100 billion from just to keep our accounts constant and enable us to turn over the money and generate GDP? We've got to borrow it from the banks. So there's not a necessary causal relationship, because the other possibility is total money supply falls by $100 billion. You spend less money because of that, and GDP falls by $200 billion. So government running a surplus rather than saving money is actually destroying it. It either encourages us to find it from another source, which puts us in debt to the private banks, or it cuts down the amount of money we can use to generate GDP and causes the economy to go into a recession. And that's very simply just the accounting of what happens if you run a surplus from the government point of view. You're destroying money. You're not saving it. You're destroying it.
Right. Okay. So, so getting back to this debt, to where we are in the United States in terms of debt, and the other countries that are sort of the aftermath of that crisis that came from over leveraging. Tell us who the countries that are zombies to be, and what the implications are for the rest of the world. Who are maybe just sort of, you know, post-zombies.
Yeah, well, the ones of the Walking Dead that are those that had a crisis pretty much back in either 1990 for Japan or 2008 for America, most of Europe and the UK. So they've got suppressed amounts of credit demand because they've got too much private debt already. The countries that appeared to avoid the crisis back in 2008, and that's particularly China, ultimately, but also Australia and Canada and Korea, all those countries and quite a few others avoided the crisis by accelerating the rate of private borrowing. So rather than going in reverse like America did, they stimulated private borrowing. In Australia's case, that was through grants to government grants that restarted the housing bubble quite deliberately, similar in Canada, and then also, of course, those countries gearing up for China's gigantic credit stimulus. When the Chinese reaction to the collapse in their exports and the immediate aftermath of the financial crisis back in 2008 was to basically tell Chinese banks, who were pretty much state-owned anyway, to lend to anybody with a pulse. And what you had in China in one year, the increase in private debt in 1 year in China was equivalent to 40% of China's GDP.
Wow.
And they've pretty much sustained a rate of growth of debt over the next 8 years or so of roughly 25% of GDP every year. Now, what that means is China in particular has gone from being a very low-geared country on global standards, having a private debt level of about 100% of GDP, to about 220% if you compare it using the same figures the Bank of International Settlements publishes for other countries. And so it spent 1.2 times its own GDP in addition to its GDP in the last 8 years. And that, of course, has stimulated demand all around the world. Now, they've got more capacity to switch over to government money creation than other countries do because of the communist nature of their government. They're not worried about being, you know, kicked out by the other party. There is no other party. But they're going to have a credit crunch. The rate of growth of private debt has to slow down. When it slows down, that credit-based demand evaporates, and we're therefore talking about losing aggregate demand from the global economy of roughly one quarter of China. And of course, China is now the world's second biggest economy. When you throw in the others into the mix, Australia, Canada, South Korea, but also Belgium, Norway, Sweden, there's about between nine and 16 countries that I think are on the verge of a financial crisis themselves. That's equivalent to the American GDP. So that many countries who have the huge amount of credit-based demand is much of a stimulus for the global economy as America itself was back in 2008. That's going to disappear in the next 1 to 3 years.
Wow. So just going back to China a little bit and comparing it to, you know, it seems to me China has, like you say, because the political limitations aren't there necessarily in the way that they are in other countries. And China has the ability, right, to replace that debt-financed demand with basically government demand, right, the government spending.
And did that, to the extent
that we had QE, I guess, 1, 2, and 3 in this country, quantitative easing, which at least in the way that it's executed, I found to be not necessarily as efficient as it could be. But was that what basically, is that the same dynamic where basically we see that we have the leveraged created demand, or leverages created demand, is replaced by just basically the Fed pumping money into the system, even though it went maybe to people who weren't necessarily going to go out and spend it in the way that maybe homeowners would have. But is that, in terms of the broad dynamic, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's a pretty effective analogy. I mean, what happened with QE, and this really reflects, again, the nature of economic theory, where and also politicians being beholden to the financial sector in the West in a way that doesn't apply in China. When the financial crisis occurred, the most important thing for the politicians was to rescue the financial sector. They never asked whether it was too big in the first place. So QE, which was run, in America's case, was running at about $1 trillion a year, for some substantial time, that $1 trillion was buying assets off the banking sector. And that meant they went from having income-generating bonds, which may have been of shonky value, of course, but nonetheless income-generating, they went from that to cash in hand. And with the cash in hand, they had a lower yield, so that gave them an encouragement to go and buy shares with that money. But when they bought the shares, that the money they spent ended up back in bank accounts anyway, because the reserves just ended up in another bank, wherever the bank or the broker they bought the shares through. But that $1 billion per year drove up the value of the S&P and the Dow Jones and so on. And the people who in the private sector then sold their shares to the banks who were buying it off them, they may have spent, say, 90% of that buying other shares or buying property, maybe 10% end up in the real economy. So of that $1 trillion a year, maybe $100 billion dribbled into from Wall Street into Main Street and gave us a bit of a stimulus and enabled the economy to turn around. In China's case, they won't have any niceties about that. If they decide the government needs to stimulate private spending and they've got the worries about, you know, workers in coastal cities moving back to the countryside and all the political dislocation that implies, if they decide to put $1 trillion a year in, they'll do $1 trillion worth of actual infrastructure building, and they'll employ those people in real jobs. So they'll get 10 times the bang for the buck that the West got out of QE, and they may even go further by using that as a way, a form of disguised foreign aid in building things like the Silk Road through Kazakhstan and so on. Mm. So they will stimulate much more effectively than the American economy stimulated its own system due to the Federal Reserve's kowtowing to the financial sector.
And that was just, I mean, that even the QE 1, 2, and 3 here, that was also just simply a political decision, right? I mean, it, you know, my understanding is that according to Barney Frank, I think it was Paulson was willing to give it to homeowners, but couldn't get Obama to sign off on it as he was president-elect.
That's right. We had a whole lot of principles about, you know, using the money to take people out who were underwater in their mortgages and pay them out so they didn't go bankrupt and didn't have to leave their houses. And the amount of money that was actually supposed to be there was quite gigantic, but an absolutely trivial amount of it was actually exercised. And rather than the money rescuing homeowners, it rescued the people who lent to them in the first place. Most of them should have gone behind bars rather than being rescued.
And if you'd given it to the homeowners, you would have had a second order bailout, I guess, of those lenders. Whereas they thought it could go the other direction, and it didn't seem to go that way at all because people were too incentivized by fees for foreclosures rather than actually getting these homeowners, you know, safe in their homes.
That's right. So if you rescued the financial sector indirectly by rescuing the people who are underwater with debt, you would have done them the economy a service and also rescued the financial sector. Instead, you rescued the financial sector and inflated the value of shares and left people with homes that they were underwater in at the same time. So it was you couldn't have done it in a more unfair fashion.
Let's talk about the three ideas that you have to lower our collective personal debt piles. I guess in China, it's one of the few places where that it's actually some of these ideas are actually potentially going to be put into use because of, you know, they don't have the same sort of political calculations that the rest of us do.
Yeah, I mean, the main idea that I have is we know that the government can create money. The central bank has been doing that to the tune of $1 trillion a year for the financial sector. Therefore, it's possible for the central bank to create that money and put it into people's bank accounts with the caveat that if it goes into the bank account of somebody who's got debt, their debt's reduced by the amount of the money that's put into their account. If it goes to somebody without debt, then they could get that cash either say to spending money, or they could be told you can now go and buy shares with that money. So we wouldn't be rewarding unfairly people who gambled and speculated against those who did not. We'd get people out of private debt by effectively replacing debt-based money with fiat-based money. But we'd also then enable those who were savers and turn their eyes of disdain at the bubble of the dot-com bubble and the subprime bubble, give them money, which would give them either equity in the companies, which would then pay down the company's debt, or they could go shopping. So rather than the usual process of eliminating debt actually causes a depression, this would be a way to stimulate the economy and reduce debt at the same time.
And again, that's just you're giving it to the people who don't have debt is really as much a political choice as anything else, right? I mean, I mean, the idea is to reduce the debt, but you don't want to get caught up in that stuff. I mean, and we had this. People forget that George W. Bush, I don't remember exactly when it was, but maybe in 2007, maybe it was in 2006, maybe it was 2005, but he sent a check to everybody.
Yeah, and the same thing happened in Australia, because I was actually at a pivotal role in that, because I was warning about a crisis and coming in Australia. And the day after I made that warning on the major current affairs program. The Prime Minister was hammered on the same program, and a week later brought out a stimulus package that including giving everybody who'd paid their taxes that year a $1,000 tax rebate. And the spending from that $1,000 was a major reason why Australia did not fall into a recession at the time. So it's quite feasible to do. It has been done in the past. It's just this, oh, we can't do this, but let's use $1 trillion to buy financial assets off the wealthy anyway. And what we ended up with, we've actually amplified the inequality and the overvaluation of assets that was caused by the crisis in the first place.
But paying off the personal debt is also important in your calculation, because ultimately, with that hanging around, it becomes a problem once that initial stimulus sort of basically, I guess, evens out in the economy.
Yeah, what you want to do is get back to the levels of debt, private debt, that America had back in the 50s and 60s. And that was a level of debt of between 30 to 70% of GDP versus the 170% you peaked at during the crisis. And with that lower level of debt, people are therefore not spending most of their spare money servicing their debt. They've got a capacity to borrow money in credit and spend it into the economy. You'd want to channel that towards productive borrowing rather than towards speculative borrowing. But you'd then get a source of demand, which America had all the way from 1945 to 2007, which is credit-based demand. So if that disappears, then you lose something of the order of 10% of your demand into your economy, and therefore you remain in a permanent slump, a credit stagnation rather than secular stagnation, as Larry Summers mischaracterizes it as. So you need that private sector borrowing to finance investment, and we no longer have it. That's why the economy is in a funk.
So how do you, I mean, let's say that you were able to convince Donald Trump, or let's just say Jared Kushner, who could then tell Donald Trump what to do. You should be sending a check to every American for, I don't know what the number would be. I mean, you've probably done the calculations, but let's just say for the sake of argument, it's $1,000. Everybody gets a check for $1,000. The only strings attached to this is that if you have debt over a certain amount of dollars, that $1,000 must go to pay off the credit card or whatever it is. Maybe the number needs to be bigger. I don't know, but just for the sake of argument. Okay, so once that's done, and let's say our aggregate personal debt is down to 70%. What reforms do you put in place to prevent the growth in debt finance demand after that?
Yeah, well, you've got to get banks away from simply living on collateralized lending. So banks lend against an asset these days. They really don't care about your income. They care about whether they're going to have an asset if you can't pay the debt back. Stop that happening by basically limiting how much money you can borrow against an asset to the income earning capacity of that asset. So I'd say, like, if you had a house which was earning, say, $20,000 rent per year, then the maximum amount anyone could borrow, that's me or Donald Trump, to buy the place would be 10 times that, say, $200,000. And therefore, the winner would be the person who saved more money to buy it, not the person who borrowed more money and leave it up to buy the place. So you'd break that asset bubble. Now, having done that, of course, you take away the main way banks have made money in the last 20 years. So you've got to give them an alternative. And I would like to, in effect, blend venture capitalism with banking. So it enable banks to make what I call entrepreneurial equity loans, or EELs, make those loans to corporations or to investors, to its innovators. And of course, you might lend to five innovators and four might fold. At the moment, if you lend in debt, then you want to get an interest stream from the one who survives, and you lose 80% of your equity, your capital. But if you took an equity position, then you'd lose in four of the five, you'd lose your equity. But the fifth one, who would become the Tesla or whatever else in the marketplace, you'd make a bomb out of that, and that would justify the loans overall. So we have to stop letting banks make money out of financial speculation, and make it possible for them to make money out of financing entrepreneurs.
When you talk about what that would do in terms of, let's say, the housing market in this country, I mean, if you were only able to sort of borrow, you know, X times what the actual potential for ongoing income could be from that asset. Is that what's happening in Germany? I've been reading a little bit that Germany, despite the fact the economy is doing well, the home prices are actually stabilizing, if not falling. Is that, am I right about that? And is that, where does Germany fit in between the walking dead of debt and zombies to be?
It's about the only one that's immune. Partly it does come back to the real estate market in Germany, because in Germany you get incredibly good rights if you're a tenant. Once you're a tenant, it's almost impossible for the landlord to evict you unless you seriously don't pay your rent at all. And if you want to put a painting up on the wall, that's fine, go right ahead, it's your property. In fact, lease terms in Germany normally require the lessee to supply the kitchen. I don't mean the knives and forks. I mean the refrigerator, the stove, everything. So you have that level of rights. You don't have the pressure to buy somewhere. And also, it's not possible for landlords to flip properties in the way that was so popular in America in the subprime bubble. So consequently, people buy houses to live in. They don't buy houses as investments. Mm-hmm. They buy them as residences to live in. Renters treat them the same way. The money doesn't get thrown into housing. So German banks, if they're going to make money, they've got to finance German firms. And consequently, you get private money creation financing innovation and technological progress. And that gives Germany a very strong economy. So rather than the falling house prices being a sign of a weak economy in Germany's case, they're part of its strength.
All right. So lastly, and I want to also just talk a little bit about why you've set up a Patreon account. But before we get to that, lastly, okay, so assuming Jared Kushner does not take your advice, he does not have this conversation with his father-in-law, what are we looking at? I mean, you foresee these problems with the zombies to be. Are those of us who are in the countries in the walking dead of debt, are we not really in danger only because once these zombies walk into this buzzsaw, we're all in trouble and it's going to freeze the amount of debt financed demand that we are creating? Or what happens between a year and 3 years from now?
Well, first of all, you're right about if the zombies to be walk into the same debt crap we've all walked into, and they're all heading straight there right now. That means that the credit-based demand in those economies will evaporate, and therefore the exports they buy from America are going to decline. So you're going to get an increase in America's trade deficit coming out of that, and less money in the economy. And that will compound the fact that with a debt level currently of 1.5 times GDP, when you had your crisis at 1.7 times GDP, there's not much headroom for credit-based demand domestically in America either. So you get a bit of a revival going on, but that would be very, very fragile and particularly very sensitive to the Federal Reserve putting up interest rates, which it looks like they're going to do because, as I said, they've got models of the economy that don't include private debt at all. So they're not looking at the Katie and I are talking about whatsoever in deciding whether they should put rates up or not. So the economy will go into a funk out of both declining exports, increase in interest rates, which is unjustified, and credit then began evaporating once more after it's recovered a bit after the crisis, and you'll go back into another slump again. It might even be blamed on Jared Kushner's father-in-law, but in fact it'll be caused by the dynamics of debt that reflect what's been happening in the bubble since 1990.
Interesting. And all right, so lastly, let's touch on this one point. What you're doing yourself in terms of your writing and speaking is interesting in and of itself. Just briefly tell us what has happened, and part of this has to do with what's going on in the UK's educational system, but tell us what's going on, why you ended up starting a Patreon account.
Yeah, well, it really comes down to the fact that mainstream economics, which has caused the economic crisis we're in now by ignoring the financial aspects of capitalism and ignoring its dynamics and believing it's a system that tends towards equilibrium, that they get all the money. They dominate all the major universities. Places like Princeton employ people like Krugman rather than me. So critics like myself have actually understand capitalism better than its so-called fans. We get lousy jobs in lousy universities with fragile student numbers, and frankly, I've had enough of it. So given the fact that I've built a fair bit of a reputation by being a critic of mainstream economics, I thought I can actually go out and get funded by the public and probably get a more reliable income stream from them and more capacity to finance the sort of innovation I need to produce in the software package I'm building that I call Minsky to do dynamic monetary modeling, I can get that from the public. It's more reliable than relying upon the university sector, which has been captured by mainstream economists and basically starves people like myself rather than feeding us when we're the ones that are needed to turn capitalism around.
Well, Professor Steve Keen, we will put a link to that Patreon as well as your website and to your book. Really appreciate your coming on the program today. Thanks so much.
I really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks very much indeed.
Bye-bye.